Lecture 8, The Coming World.
The singer-songwriter Sting has a song called Consider Me Gone, in which one of the lyrics is, "But to look for heaven is to live here in hell." It gets at an idea, that is central to the origins of our discussion in this lecture about Olam Haba, the world to come, or the coming world. Actually, Olam Haba can be referring to two things. It can be referring to this world that's coming in the future, in other words, the messianic era of this world in the future, but we already talked about that in the last lecture. Or it can be referring to what we experience after we die in the world that we come into. So that's the way that we're going to talk about that term, Olam Haba, not in terms of the messianic era of this world, but the world in which we all inherit or come into after our existence on this planet is finished. Rabbinic Judaism, as well as Christianity, understands that there is another world that we come into. But Rabbinic Judaism and Christianity understand that. It is surprising how little information there is in the Tanakh about the world to come or what happens after we die. The Tanakh is almost exclusively concerned with life in this world. Among the rewards for following the mitzvot of the Torah is that the Israelites will be enabled to continue living in the land of Israel and not be dispossessed by their neighbors. It says in the Decalogue, honor your father and your mother. I try to do that periodically. I try to do that all the time. Honor your father and your mother, that you may long endure on the land that the Lord your God is assigning to you. What immortality means for the Israelites in the Hebrew Bible is that their posterity, their progeny, their descendants will be able to stay in the land unmolested. So it's not about individual immortality, it's about the immortality of the line. Nowhere in the entire Tanakh is there a promise of reward in the afterlife. There are indeed a few verses in the Tanakh which mention the afterlife. But what is shocking to those of us that think that heaven and hell must be in the Bible because they're such important parts of Christianity and Judaism, when someone dies in the Tanakh, it doesn't matter whether they're a saint or a sinner, they go to the same place. It doesn't matter what your deeds were in this world. In the Hebrew Bible, when you die, everybody goes to Sheol. Sheol is this shadowy underworld in the bowels of the earth kind of place. We don't really know what happens there. It's only mentioned in a handful of texts. One of those texts is Psalm 6:6. There it says, "For there is no praise of you, God, among the dead." So one thing we know about Sheol is that you can't praise God there. We only have in the Hebrew Bible the Witch of Endor, one person in the book of Samuel who actually comes back from Sheol, and she's very upset that she was summoned in order to come back. We don't really have a very good understanding of what the Israelites must have believed about life in that next world, life in Sheol. For one reason or another, the authors of the texts that went into the Hebrew Bible wanted to downplay and suppress any information and keep the focus on this world. I think partially that reflects their understanding that's in resonance with that quote from Sting that I began with. We don't need to look. If we start looking for heaven, it's an admission that we live here in hell. And first of all, that's not very grateful. It doesn't show much gratitude. But also, when the texts of the Hebrew Bible were written, many of those texts, the Jews had sovereignty in the land and their children were inheriting, and it was, and the immortality was being succeeded. Right? There was a successful notion of maintaining a presence in the land. So they didn't need that kind of speculation about what happens in the afterlife, because things were generally good in this world. And it's when things are bad in this world that you look toward reward in the afterlife. When things are good in this world and you're sitting on top of the hill, right, and things are dandy, then you're much more likely to not have any thoughts about the next world, because this world is just fine, thank you very much. The idea of resurrection of some dead is a late and marginal idea in the Hebrew Bible. There are very few texts which unambiguously refer to the physical resurrection of the dead. You've got a handful in Isaiah, and then perhaps the most famous is in Daniel. And the text in Daniel, which we're about to read, is the only text that can be dated with accuracy. Here's the text from Daniel. "It will be a time of trouble, the like of which has never been seen since the nation came into being. At that time, your people will be rescued, all who are found inscribed in the book. Many of those that sleep in the dust of the earth will awake, some to eternal life, others to reproaches, to everlasting abhorrence." In other words, not everybody that lived is going to be resurrected, but only a few people, some for eternal life, and some for reproaches and everlasting abhorrence. That's one of the clearest texts we have about resurrection. We have clear texts about resurrection in Isaiah, in Ezekiel also, in Ezekiel 37, the Valley of the Dry Bones. But there, the image of the bones having flesh and sinews placed upon them, that's a metaphor for national resurrection of the Israelite, of the Jewish people at this point when they come back from Babylonia. So the idea of resurrection must have been out there, and we know that it was part of Persian religion. So the image was used in Ezekiel and in other places as well, but the theology of the individual being resurrected after they die at some point in the future, that we find in very few texts, and the texts that we can date accurately are very late. It turns out that Daniel is one of the very last texts to have been written that made it into the canon of the Hebrew Bible. Perhaps it was the last text. And it was written during the time of the war between the Syrian Greeks and the Maccabees that we celebrate each year in the festival of Hanukkah. That was a period when there were lots and lots and lots of Jews being killed for trying to maintain the ways of their fathers, the ancestral customs, the ancestral traditions. And so it's at that point when things are really bad that this idea emerges or reemerges of the resurrection of the dead at some point in the future for those people who were meritorious in this life. In other words, for the good Jews that kept God's will, God's ways, the halakha, in this world, even though this world is terrible and we're being martyred and we're being violated by the Syrian Greeks, there's another world to look forward to in the future that will allow us to reap the rewards and the benefits that we deserve for eternity. And how much better is it to reap rewards for eternity than whatever insignificant rewards you could reap in this world for a finite period of time? So again, in the Hebrew Bible, the resurrection of the dead is a relatively late and marginal idea. The other idea that's involved in the world to come is the immortality of the soul. That idea appears nowhere in the Hebrew Bible. Nowhere. The words that are translated into English as soul or spirit, they can mean other things in biblical Hebrew. So for instance, at the very beginning of Genesis, we have the Ruach of God hovering over the surface of the water. Well, the Ruach can also be translated as spirit, right? It is translated as spirit in the King James translation. But for instance, in the New Jewish Publication Society translation, they have it as the wind of God hovers over the surface of the deep. Ruach in modern Hebrew can mean wind or it can mean spirit. In Genesis 2:7, God breathes the breath of life, the soul, into the first human being in the second creation story anyway. And we do seem to have these separate elements of the body and the soul. But it seems as though what's going on there is that neither the body nor the soul are these independent, autonomous entities. The soul is that which animates the body. And when the body dies, the soul disappears. Ecclesiastes 12:7 picks up on that verse in Genesis and refers to the spirit returning to God. Ecclesiastes says, "And the dust returns to the ground as it was," right? The dust, the physical body, "and the life breath returns to God who bestowed it." And then his next line, his refrain, Ecclesiastes says, "Utter futility," said Kohelet, "all is futile." In other words, even for Kohelet, there is no immortality of the soul, but the human body is composed of these two things, and when the body is finished and expires and returns to the dust that it was created from, the soul that animates the body also returns to its source, which was the life breath of God. You don't have an idea of a separate body and separate spirit in Judaism until you have the arrival of Hellenism brought by Alexander the Great, when Alexander the Great conquered that territory around the year 330. That notion of a body-soul dualism, that then penetrates Judaism, and we see it very much prominently displayed in the understandings of the human body that we have in both Christianity and Rabbinic Judaism. Even before that, with the Pharisees and late Second Temple Judaism, they're the earliest Jews that we know about to support the ideas of resurrection and immortality of the soul. So although the immortality of the soul is post-biblical, it's pre-rabbinic. And although resurrection is a late and marginal idea within the Hebrew Bible, it is central to how the Pharisees, not the Sadducees, understand the human anthropology or human psychology or divine theology. And what the Pharisees understood was then inherited by the rabbis. Now, there's irony in the Pharisees accepting the Hellenistic notion of the immortality of the soul and the Sadducees rejecting it, since usually the Pharisees are perceived to be less Hellenistic than the Sadducees. But you take from your environment whatever works for your own agenda, for your own theology, for your own understanding of the world. And in this case, that Hellenistic idea of the separation of the body and the soul worked for the Pharisees and for the rabbis, I think precisely because they were living through this time of turmoil where it was so obvious that people weren't being rewarded for their righteous deeds of following God's will, and people weren't being punished in this world for ignoring God's will, for ignoring the halakha. So if you want to hold on to God's goodness and God's justice in this hand, and God's power in this hand, then you need to have a forum, a realm, a space where God's justice will eventually be transparent. Since it's not transparent in this world, it must be that there's another world in which God's goodness and justice obtains for all. That idea is called theodicy, justifying God's ways in this world. God can allow bad things to happen to good people in this world because God has the power and God's good and just that ultimately there will be another world in which people will get their just deserts. Now, as we move into Rabbinic Judaism, it will not surprise you at this point that the ideas involved in the world to come were matters of disagreement. Wildly, wild disagreements amongst the rabbis themselves. It's true that resurrection and the immortality of the soul became absolutely central in rabbinic thought. But what that meant and in what sequence things would happen, we don't really know because the rabbis weren't interested in systematic theology. So although you've got lots of statements in the Talmud, in the Gemara, not the Mishnah so much, but in the Talmud and in the Midrash about resurrection of the dead and the immortality of the soul and heaven and hell, you don't have anything that really spells out exactly what happens to whom when, that everybody agrees on. You have it from individual rabbis, but if you disagree with the individual rabbi, right, you're in good company. Lots of rabbis disagree with other rabbis. In the aftermath of the destruction of the Second Temple and the failure of the Bar Kokhba revolt, the idea of the world to come served, as I said, as a kind of theodicy, but without undermining the importance of halachic commitment to life in this world. Because you still needed to behave according to God's will, the halakha, if you wanted to be rewarded in the next world. The person that says this most pithily is Rabbi Yaakov, who says, "This world is like a hallway before the world to come. Prepare yourself in the hallway so that you may enter the banquet hall." Now, if you think about that image, this world is like a hallway. So you're invited to the party of the king. Do you stick around in the hallway for very long? No. All the real action is happening in the banquet hall. So you spend very little time in the hallway. You want to get to the banquet hall and enjoy what the host has prepared for you. This, my friends, is a Copernican revolution in Judaism, where the emphasis really shifts from what it was in the Tanakh, life in this world, to what Rabbi Yaakov says, life in the world to come. That's where the banquet is. But people that agree with Rabbi Yaakov have to construct this new understanding of where the action is, namely life in the world to come, in a way that doesn't undermine their commitment to life in this world. So there's a wide variety of comments on life in the afterworld within rabbinic literature. What's clear is that one's experience in the coming world depends on one's actions in this world. So the halakha is still very important to rabbinic Judaism. Now, heaven, at this point, we have a bifurcation. Good folks go to what we can call heaven in English, and bad folks go to what we will call hell. Let's talk about heaven first. Heaven is also sometimes called in rabbinic sources Gan Eden, the Garden of Eden. And it's described as a physical paradise, but it's also described as a place where there's no eating or drinking, but only basking in the radiance of God's presence, right? A very kind of ethereal reality. Now, for those whose deeds in this world do not merit attaining life in the world to come, some rabbis believe that being cut off from that reward, is punishment enough, right? You don't need to have any kind of active torture or punishment, because not getting to bask in the divine presence in the Garden of Eden, that's hellacious enough. Other rabbis do describe temporary torments, and there's even one, or maybe a handful, that subscribe to what we saw in Daniel, this idea of eternal torment. But those ideas are very marginal. The idea of a just God punishing someone for eternity, that just doesn't have resonance for the rabbis. A common rabbinic name for what we call hell is Gehenna. Now, in Israel today, outside of Jerusalem, there's a place that shows old movies called the Cinematheque. And you look out toward the old city while you're having beers or coffee, and there's a valley that separates the Cinematheque from the walls of the old city. It's beautiful, particularly at night. That valley is called Gehinnom. And the Bible talks about how in that valley in Jerusalem, that's where the Canaanites would sacrifice their children to their god Molech. So Gehinnom is the worst possible thing for the rabbis that they can imagine doing in this world, sacrificing their children. So that's why their word for hell was based on Gehinnom or Gehenna. Now, in general, the Mishnah is lenient about who gets into the world to come. Right? Righteous Gentiles get into the world to come. All Jews have a portion in the world to come. But among those people that don't make it in are those who deny that the Torah mentions resurrection of the dead. So you see that that concept of resurrection of the dead becomes a self-defining element within the early period of rabbinic Judaism. When we get to the Middle Ages, we have Maimonides. And Maimonides is very interested in systematizing this welter of rabbinic opinion about life in the world to come. So he presents and explains the range of rabbinic opinion on what happens when we die. He says as follows, that those rabbinic statements that characterize the coming world as a place of physical delights and material comforts, you shouldn't read those literally. right? Just like you shouldn't read The Lion and the Lamb literally, Maimonides was a big proponent of metaphorical reading. And he makes the following comparison. Often, when we teach our children, we give them sweet rewards or we pay them for every A that they have on their report card until they mature and realize that the reward for learning is learning itself. But you want to get people who are immature accustomed to doing good things until they figure out that doing good things and following God's way is enough of a reward all by itself. Now, one of those rabbinic statements by Roth represents a contrasting view and one with which Maimonides agrees. So let's read that. In the coming world, there is no eating, drinking, procreating. Procreating. You think about how some other religions encourage martyrdom, right? The idea that they will be have a nice stock of virgins with which to enjoy. But according to Roth, in the coming world, there is no eating, drinking, procreating, business, jealousy, hatred, or competition. Rather, the righteous sit with their crowns on their heads, enjoying the radiance of the divine presence. Roth said that in the Talmud. One of the Talmudic sages said that. Maimonides, 800 years later, says, you know what? That's what life in the world to come is all about. So then what's the problem? The problem is the resurrection of the dead. See, there's a tension between these two ideas. Resurrection of the dead is body, good. You want to live in this world, that's good. Immortality of the soul is body bad, soul good. What you want to do is break away from the confines of this body so that the soul can return to its source and bask in the divine radiance. Well, you can't bask in the divine radiance if you've been resurrected and you're living here on earth. So we see that there's tension between this Eastern idea of resurrection of the dead and this Hellenistic idea of the immortality of the soul. They both work their way into rabbinic Judaism and to Christianity, but they don't sit so comfortably side by side. So here's, and Maimonides recognizes this, of course, so here's how Maimonides reconciles the tension here. He says, for those who are not righteous, they don't receive any reward, and that's punishment enough. Not enjoying the radiance of the divine presence, that's the ultimate punishment. Righteousness, which is defined by adherence to the commandments as well as intellectual attainment, that's what allows you to bask in the divine radiance. And this is how he presents, this is how Maimonides presents the sequence of events in the messianic future. So now we're talking about Olam Haba in this world, not the world to come. He says the righteous and only the righteous will be resurrected. So when the Messiah comes, there'll be a resurrection for the righteous, but then they'll die again, right? They're not going to live eternally in the body because the whole point is to get back to God's presence and to bask in that radiance. Afterward, after all, the ultimate reward for the Aristotelian Maimonides is for the soul to delight in that divine radiance. Resurrection imposes that physical barrier for the individual. That Messiah arrives, kingship will return to Israel, and Jews will return to the land of Israel. The natural order, as we saw before, will not change. Everyone, Jew and Gentile, living in those peaceful times will have a share in the world to come after they die, right? Because by definition, they will be participating in this messianic era. They will be peaceful. They will not resort to violence. And so they will also enjoy basking in the divine presence. The Messiah, who sort of caps that experience, he'll die. He's a human being. He'll die. And then his son will succeed him in Davidic dynastic succession. So Maimonides takes this welter of rabbinic opinion and tries to systematize it. We should also mention one other aspect of life in the world to come. We don't see this in the Bible at all. We don't see this in the Talmud at all, nor would we ever see this with Maimonides, who was very rationalistic. But in the mystical stream of Judaism, known as the Kabbalah, which we'll talk about in a future lecture, there was the idea of reincarnation. Reincarnation in Hebrew is Gilgul HaNefeshot, the rolling over of souls or the rolling over of spirits. It's a basic concept within Jewish mysticism. You find it in the earliest medieval mystical texts from the 13th century, but it really becomes a widespread concept within the Jewish community beginning in the 16th century, and then later on Hasidism further popularizes the idea of reincarnation. Sometimes the idea of reincarnation was conceived as an opportunity to do teshuvah for previous transgressions. So, for instance, there's a Hasidic text that says someone who spread slander or spread gossip during their life, they would be reincarnated as a buzzing bee, and they would have to spend that whole existence. Bzz, bzz, that would be their punishment. Another idea that we find for the reason why someone would be reincarnated is that it would provide them with another opportunity to complete their task or their mission in this life that they didn't have time to complete for one reason or another. So as we try to wrap up this lecture, think about how incredibly influential ideas from foreign cultures were as they then became absorbed into the Jewish mind or into the Jewish consciousness. We don't see resurrection of the dead very often in the Hebrew Bible, but it becomes a defining characteristic of what it meant to be a Pharisee as opposed to a Sadducee, and then it becomes absolutely doctrinal for rabbinic Judaism. Immortality of the soul appears nowhere in the Hebrew Bible, but again, it becomes absolutely central for the Pharisees who lived in the wake of the Hellenistic Alexander the Great's conquest of those lands, of the land of Israel and points east. And also for the rabbis, the immortality of the soul was absolutely central to their understanding of how God could then provide a realm in which the folks that were suffering so tragically in this world, although they were leading a righteous life from the rabbi's perspective, providing another venue whereby, through the immortality of the soul, they would be able to be compensated for having suffered in this world, although they lived a righteous life. And of course, the opposite is true as well. Those people who were acting despicably in this world, but seem to be on top of the hill, they will receive their comeuppance in the world to come. My introductory lecture to the course talked about different Judaisms. We could really title this class Introduction to Judaisms. This is a good place to say, look, there were all kinds of different opinions about the Messiah, whether it's apocalyptic or utopian, what will bring the Messiah, whether we'll know beforehand that the Messiah is going to come, different ideas about resurrection of the dead and the immortality of the soul and where the Messiah fits into that. You've got the Middle Ages where Maimonides wants to read these texts figuratively, talking about political stability and political sort of strength of Israel and in relation to its surrounding neighbors. And Nachmanides says, no, it's very different. Nachmanides is part of a mystical tradition who understands that nature will really change in the Messianic world. And then, of course, in the mystical tradition, you also have this concept of reincarnation of the souls. So how can these two people, Maimonides and Nachmanides, pray at the same synagogue and belong to the same congregation and be part of this enterprise we call Judaism, even though their understandings about the world and the future and the world to come are so different? I think one reason why they're still Jews is because of their commitment to life in this world and their commitment to engaging in the traditional commandments as a way of responding to their perception of reality that God is present in the world, that God is a reality, and they want to respond to that reality. We also see, as I mentioned before, that Reform Judaism inherited these ideas of resurrection of the dead and immortality of the soul. They no longer felt comfortable with the resurrection of the dead, so they got rid of it, but they kept immortality of the soul. What's slightly ironic about that is that what they got rid of, the resurrection of the dead, that at least has some basis in the Hebrew Bible. What they kept, the immortality of the soul, that, as we've seen, has no basis in the Bible. But nevertheless, it is absolutely central to rabbinic Judaism, and it's also central to contemporary Reform Judaism's understanding of life in the coming world. So this concludes our lectures on major concepts within Rabbinic Judaism. Our next few sessions are going to focus on holiness in time, and we'll be looking specifically at Shabbat, at the Sabbath that comes every 7 days. And for many people, we understand that the Sabbath is the most important day in the Jewish calendar, and it comes every 7 days, so we get a lot of practice in celebrating that most important day. And it's also appropriate that we start our discussion of holiness and time with the Sabbath, because the rabbis say that Shabbat, or the Sabbath, is a taste of the world to come.